This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, a short film that follows a local musician who turned the sounds of a wine harvest into music is screening at the SLO International Film Festival.
He processes all these sounds in the computer and turns them into instruments, and it's fascinating to watch.
Also, learn about the connected history of people of color on the Central Coast with historian and artist Shizwe Siegel.
And I think especially for younger people nowadays, there are more and more cross-cultural relationships, friendships, etc.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 29th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with the movie Harvest Calls. With the KCBX Arts Beat, here's Amanda Wernick.
When Brooke Monroe isn't creating music, he's crafting wine in Edna Valley. The film Harvest Calls follows Monroe's journey to create his album Harvest in 12 Parts. Monroe blended the sounds of instruments with noises like grapes being juiced and birds chirping in the vineyard. He's worked at Claiborne and Churchill Winery for more than 15 years and has noticed similarities in the creative process of both winemaking and composing music.
Every person creating said thing, whether it's music or wine, they're going to have their own personality infused into it.
Winery co-owner Claiborne Thompson says he was excited when Monroe asked to record sounds at the winery. He said he wanted to see how harvest season would be artistically expressed.
Harvest is the key part of the year, and the music that Brooke created is much more esoteric than the reality of crushing grapes and so forth, but the connections are so beautiful.
With the boss on board, Monroe then decided to ask local filmmaker Kyle Plummer, a friend and longtime collaborator, to capture the process in a film. Plummer says he was immediately interested.
He processes all these sounds in the computer and turns them into instruments, and it's fascinating to watch.
Plummer signed on to direct a documentary. In his favorite scene, sunlight filtered through grape leaves, illuminating Monroe and local cellist Bob Leitman's faces in the vineyard.
It was an amazing moment where the light hit perfectly, and you see Brooke is like conducting with his hands in the air, and Bob is playing in the middle.
The two came up with the song Under the Harvest Sky on the spot. Monroe mixed the four-note cello line with birds chirping and more natural harvest sounds.
I bring that in with the sounds of fresh juice being pressed, the sound of pomace after the juice has been squeezed out, and you have all these grape skins that have just been flattened out and just like touching it and feeling it.
Monroe says he also wanted to capture the ups and downs of harvest season through more dynamic tracks like Crush Eternal.
During harvest, you're always up against the odds. There's always things that aren't working out, some years more so than others. And I wanted to find a sonic expression of that.
On top of instruments and natural sounds, Monroe also used more experimental recording techniques. In the track Thieves of Joy, he turns wine glasses into instruments.
We actually filled up a bunch of wine glasses and tuned them. We found particular pitches that we were looking for, and then using violin bows to bow them and creating chords with that.
Plummer says Monroe's bold experimentation is the spirit of the film. It inspired him to try new techniques with angles and lighting conditions.
I was really playing with how far I could push it and kind of the more extreme things I could do with it, like low light scenarios, natural light scenarios.
And Monroe hopes the film will show that wine and music aren't as different as people might think.
Just like it was this huge manifestation of using what you have and all the best things about it and crafting something in much of the same way that you're crafting a nice, beautiful, layered, balanced wine.
For KCBX News, I'm Amanda Wernick.
You can enjoy a second screening of Harvest Calls during the Paso Encore Week. That's on Thursday, May 2nd at Park Cinemas. The virtual showing of Harvest Calls is May 1st through the 5th. You're listening to KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman with more from the Arts Beat. An annual art exhibit that highlights the talent of Cuesta College's students is teaching them how to market and exhibit their art. Here's Alyssa Toledo.
Opening weekend of the 2024 Cuesta College Students' annual art exhibition, spectators are engaging with each other in hushed conversations. Held on campus at the Harold J. Miosi Gallery, the exhibit showcases a mix of drawings, paintings, and sculptures that explore human form and figure. Timothy Stark is a coordinator with the gallery. He says the community college hosts the student-led exhibit every year to provide a platform for up-and-coming student artists at the college.
This is a chance for new artists and artists who are just, and students who are just dipping their toes into the arts to have their work handled and displayed in a professional level gallery.
Every year, Stark selects a new juror who is entrusted to curate a brand new exhibit. This year, Cal Poly SLO professor Makia Sharp was chosen to be the juror. She was recently hired as the new professor of photography at the university.
We're looking for students that are not like perfect at everything, but like have the potential to make some really great things and are currently making some really interesting student work too.
Sharp selected 60 Cuesta College students out of 200 applicants to showcase their art at the exhibit.
It was really difficult. There was a lot of great work, and the show kind of shapes itself when you start picking work, and then it kind of contextualizes itself with the other work. And so it was kind of an organic process.
Sharp says it's exciting to be the juror of the exhibit. She loves to connect with the students to see what their future plans are. During opening weekend, Sharp gave out a handful of awards such as Best in Show and honorable mentions in categories for painting, sculpture, photography, digital art, and more. Tasha Steinmiss is majoring in art studio at Cuesta College. They won the honorable mention in painting award for their piece, Bunnies. It portrays a naked human body covered in three human-like bunnies. The body is sitting on one of the creatures' backs, and the others are embracing and biting the human. They say they found it easier to describe and portray people in a more figurative way.
I don't know, I find it easier to have like creatures, and especially multiple creatures and figures and animals describing a person, because you can't have one thing describe a person.
Steinmiss says they're still figuring out themselves what the work means to them.
A group of people touring the campus walked in while I was in open lab with my headphones on doing that piece. And they crowded around my painting. They're like, this is so cool. What inspired it? What does it mean? What inspired it? I'm like, I'm still figuring that out. Give me a second, please.
Steinmiss says presenting their work to the public has been a learning process for them. They say it's tricky to balance the artistic vision while pleasing curators and viewers.
This is very different, and I've been scared of this for a long time because I was worried that if my work is shown to a lot of people, I would start making work for other people. But I also think there's a lot of benefit because without risk, it's kind of hard to grow as a person and as an artist.
Timothy Stark adds providing students with opportunities to showcase their work is a pivotal step in their artistic pursuits. It helps the students experience both rejection and praise.
Honorable mention of painting, Tasha Steinmiss.
On average, when you are participating in the arts and submitting to shows, you are not going to get into the majority of shows. It's not always selecting the best work, it's selecting the best work that fits within the show.
Stark hopes to reduce barriers at an early stage in the students' artistic careers by exempting fees in the application process.
Everything is streamlined and done specifically to get as many students to be able to submit as much artwork as possible so that we can see everybody's talent.
The exhibition is going on until May 17th. Hours of operation for the 2024 Cuesta College Students Annual Art Exhibition are posted at cuesta.edu. And for KCBX News, I'm Melissa Toledo.
The KCBX Arts Beat is made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation, San Luis Obispo County. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, author Kathy Mostico talks with KCBX's Brian Reynolds about her book on the Point San Luis Lighthouse. It's a collection of tales, true tales, not tall tales, mainly about the people who lived and worked at the lighthouse during the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Hello, I'm Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by local author and historian Kathy Mostico, who has written a new book called The Lighthouse at Point San Luis, a collection of short, true stories. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you very much for having me, Brian.
I'd like to start by having you talk a little bit about yourself, who you are, how you got here, and came to write the book.
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., and I was vaguely familiar with lighthouses on the eastern seaboard. We moved to California in 1978, and we moved to the Central Coast in 2002. I've had two careers. One was in human resources in high tech in Silicon Valley, and another was at Cal Poly. I retired twice, once from Silicon Valley and once from Cal Poly. And after I retired, I was having lunch with a friend, and she said, "You know, Kathy, you should be a volunteer docent at the lighthouse." And I said, "We have a lighthouse?" And I think that reaction is not uncommon among residents of our county. This lighthouse at Point San Luis is not one that you can see from land, and a lot of people don't know it's there. So I took her up on her suggestion, and I started training to be a docent in 2016. And we had a lot of information and a lot of stories to share with our guests, but most of those stories were from a woman who had lived at the lighthouse in the 1930s. Now, the light was first lit at Point San Luis in June of 1890. So there was a lot of history with that lighthouse before the 1930s. And I decided to do a little bit of research to learn more about the history of the lighthouse, really so that I could be a better docent. And as I started researching, I started uncovering things that I thought were very interesting about the lighthouse keepers who worked there, their families who lived there. And I started to write articles as an outlet for my research. And my first article, and there's a chapter in the book about him, was about our first head keeper, who was Henry Wilson Young. Now, we used to tell our guests that a man by the name of Steve Ballou was our first head keeper. But that wasn't true. He was a keeper, but not our first head keeper. So as I started digging and learned that our first keeper was actually Captain Henry Wilson Young, I wrote an article about him. I submitted it to the United States Lighthouse Society, and they accepted it for publication in their quarterly membership journal. That gave me the confidence to continue researching and continuing to write articles. I hadn't a plan to write a book. I was just doing research and writing articles to share my research. Then COVID hit. We could no longer give tours at our lighthouse. The light station was closed to visitors, and COVID provided an unexpected opportunity to think about taking the articles that I had written and organizing them and editing them in a way that would work as a chapter book. Our lighthouse didn't have its own book, and that isn't terribly typical. Many lighthouses in this nation have their own book, but we didn't. And so I organized the articles, did a lot of editing, sent the manuscript around, hoping for some feedback that would give me those comments that you stick on the back cover, enticing people to blurbs. Maybe buy the book, the blurbs, exactly, the accolades, whatever. And I sent a copy of the manuscript off to the United States Lighthouse Society, because not only had they published my article about Henry Young, but they had published other articles in other editions of their membership journal. And I heard nothing back from the United States Lighthouse Society.
Not even a rejection.
Not even a rejection. And then one day I got a call out of the blue from the executive director, Jeff Gale, saying, "Kathy, we've never done this before, but we'd like to publish your book." And so I spent the latter part of 2021 and most of 2022 working with someone on their staff who shepherded this book into production, who did the design and the layout, who did the cover, and put it into shape so that it could be published using the Amazon print on demand platform. So I came to writing this book in quite a roundabout way. It was never my intention. It just turned out that way.
I want to look at this from a historical perspective. Mariners throughout history have had a lot of trouble when they get near the coastlines. Rocks under the water, other problems that they didn't anticipate. And so even though there were ancient lighthouses, we're told, one of them, the Seven Wonders of the World, I guess, was a lighthouse in the Mediterranean. But in our country, the lighthouses arose as a necessity to promote safe navigation, and they're scattered along the coastlines. But what intrigues me was before there was nothing, you know, that you got into trouble and there was no lighthouse, there were no buoys, and you maybe made it through or wound up in a shipwreck and drowned. But the original lighthouses were governed by a separate division within the U.S. government. It wasn't the Coast Guard, which happened later. Tell us about that era when it was pre-Coast Guard.
So if we go back to 1789, George Washington, our first president, understood the importance of maritime traffic to the economic prosperity of this young nation. And so he persuaded Congress, and I think it was the 8th act of our first Congress, to put the lighthouses that were then in existence, mainly in New England, of course, under the control of the federal government. And so Congress created what I will call the Lighthouse Service. It went by different names, but we'll just call it the Lighthouse Service, and put the Lighthouse Service under the Treasury Department and under the first Secretary of the Treasury, who, of course, was Alexander Hamilton. That it's not in the play about Hamilton that he was in charge of the country's lighthouses, but indeed he was. So the Lighthouse Service is created, and it is staffed by civilian keepers. It was a uniformed civilian service, much like, I guess, the National Park Service. Initially, at some lighthouses prior to the late 1890s, these positions were given out occasionally as favors. Patronage was involved. In fact, Steve Ballou, who was one of our first keepers, not a head keeper, the reason that he was a keeper was because he was a Civil War vet, he was wounded in the Civil War, and he was also very active in the local Republican Party. So as a favor, he was given an appointment as a lighthouse keeper. Later, that changed, and keepers had to pass an exam. It was a competitive exam. So we have the Lighthouse Service started in 1789, and it continues for 150 years until July of 1939. And in July of 1939, FDR transferred responsibility for our nation's aids to navigation to the United States Coast Guard. And by the way, if you think that that decision went down well with employees of the United States Lighthouse Service, I can tell you it did not. Harry Willett Rhodes, who was the inspector at the time for all the lighthouses in California employed by the Lighthouse Service, wrote to his former boss and said, "I hope we live to see the day when Congress regrets having sold us down the river." Nevertheless, the Coast Guard did take over in 1939. Their motto, Semper Paratus, always ready, always prepared. They came in and they staffed our light station until 1975.
And the Coast Guard still, I know, owns the properties like up at Piedras Blancas. They own that property. You mentioned the fact that it was viewed as a favor or something desirable, but my take on the lives of the keepers and their families, it was hard. You were lonely. You're right in the ocean's path of weather. The foghorns would rattle the fillings out of your teeth. Talk about the living conditions in those days.
I think what you're saying is, of course, very true. But I would say with respect to our particular lighthouse, the lighthouse at Point San Luis, I'll talk about our first head keeper, sort of contrast. Henry Wilson Young, he was appointed as the head keeper at Point San Luis, having transferred from the lighthouse out at the Farallon Islands. Now, if you think about the Farallons, 20-some miles out the Golden Gate Bridge, that's the middle of nowhere. And Henry Wilson Young was the head keeper. His wife and he and their four kids, actually five because one drowned while they were stationed there, lived at the Farallon. So coming from the Farallons to Point San Luis, the conditions were much better. Even in 1890, you could get to town from there, town being San Luis Obispo.
By boat?
By boat, absolutely. The Lighthouse Service gave you a boat. You'd take the boat over to what was called Hartford Pier at the time, or Port Hartford, up on the narrow gauge railroad. And in 10 miles, you're in the thriving 1890 metropolis of San Luis Obispo. So yes, it was lonely, but in the case of this lighthouse, it was not so difficult to get to town. And Henry Young served at Point San Luis for 15 years. So I think it indicates that he thought it was a pretty good place to live and a pretty good assignment.
I'd like to remind everyone, I am Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by author and local historian Kathy Mastico, talking about her new book, The Lighthouse at Point San Luis, a collection of short true stories. Very interesting history in the 1890s and early 1900s. There were troubles between head keeper and assistant keepers. There were tragedies that happened to some of the families. There were schools built. What was life like in those days for the people in that region?
Well, I don't know that I know that specifically. I think that certainly when you have three families living at this 30-acre light station property, things can get tense. People can have rows and differences of opinions. And there certainly was quite the falling out in 1900 between, again, Henry Young and his first assistant keeper, Antonio Souza. And it seems rather silly, at least one of the issues seems rather silly. It had to do with Antonio Souza cutting off some branches on a tree that he didn't get permission to do from the head keeper. And there was also a scene at Port Hartford between the keeper's wife and the assistant keeper, which had to deal with commandeering a boat because Mrs. Young wanted to be taken back to the lighthouse and the assistant keeper wasn't around to take her. So she asked a local fisherman to take her in the light station's boat, which made the assistant keeper very unhappy. And apparently he used some inappropriate language in front of her. And so Henry Wilson Young tried to get him reprimanded, if not fired. And as it turned out, the issue was solved by simply transferring the assistant keeper to Point Conception and transferring an assistant keeper from Point Conception back to Point San Luis. So, you know, I mean, definitely there were issues between families and there were tragedies. Captain Henry Wilson Young's older daughter died while he was stationed there, not at the lighthouse, but died of consumption. Will Smith, who came in after Henry Young, his wife passed away 6 months after he got there. He had three teenage girls and a teenage boy, so that was tough. And then one of his daughters passed away at, I think, the age of 30, having had heart trouble. So they certainly were no strangers to tragedy. But I think that if you look at the years of service that these keepers had, these civilians, they served long periods of time, as opposed to the Coast Guard, where the rotations were very frequent. You were there for a year or two, and then you were rotated out. Their lengths of service were quite long.
One of the things that struck me about the isolation of the keepers and their families, besides just geographic, was and this, I think, carried through in your book through to the Coast Guard days, no one was allowed on the property unless they had official permission to be there. There was an exception for the Portuguese fishermen who could fish nearby because they shared the fish in their wine. Tell us about that.
So when the Lighthouse Service was in charge, actually, people could come onto the property without permission. In fact, the keepers were told that as long as it didn't interfere with their official duties, that they were to give tours of the lighthouse to visitors and they were not to charge admission. Now, that changed when the Coast Guard took over. And the Coast Guard did not permit visitors on the property, except for the Portuguese fishermen, as you say, because they shared their take and their wine with the Coast Guard servicemen who were there. Also, during the Coast Guard era, the property surrounding the lighthouse was sold to PG&E, and they started to build the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. So, yes, access to the lighthouse was definitely restricted. But it's interesting, Brian, that the Coast Guard folks actually liked the fact that access was restricted because many of them considered the light station property their own private paradise.
Interesting. I think that bound to be one of the barriers between people getting familiar with the Lighthouse Station is that it is adjacent to Diablo Canyon, which has to have top security 24/7. So you can't just drive there and walk around. You have to be part of an organized tour. I'd like to, in our last couple of moments here, why would people care about a lighthouse today when most of them are inoperative because they've been superseded by other technologies? Why do you think that's important?
I think that with regard to lighthouses, I think there's something very romantic about them. They're usually situated in spots with beautiful views, breathtaking views. And I think there's a certain nostalgia that people have for what might be considered a bygone era. I know that people are so happy to see this lighthouse and go through the head keeper's dwelling. And I think people enjoy trying to go back mentally to an earlier time in a very beautiful place.
Very true. Today we have been joined by Kathy Mostako with her book, The Lighthouse at Point San Luis, a collection of short true stories, which is available on Amazon and where else?
So you can find it at our gift shop, of course, at The Lighthouse. You can find it at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum. You can find it at Coalesce Bookstore in Morro Bay, Volumes of Pleasure in Los Osos, the Hearst Castle Gift Shop. Our History Center, of course, has copies. So does the South County Historical Society. And even a hotel at Avila Beach is carrying copies of the book. So it's available around the county.
I've loved reading the book. I read it from cover to cover. This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast with local author and historian Kathy Mostako. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you very much, Brian.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Tom Wilmer speaks with Shizwe Siegel about a local history exhibit in the works.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation with Shizwe Siegel. She is a historian, an author, a poet, and a person that creates cool events. Hi, Shizwe.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. To give you a little background, I'm a third-generation Japanese-American and just finishing up a month working with the History Center of San Luis Obispo County, preparing to do an exhibit that will be coming. And it's going to explore not only Japanese-American history, but the intersectionality with economics and with immigrants and other people of color over time. So my grandparents were immigrants that my grandfather arrived in 1907 and went to work at the Union sugar beet fields down in Bataravia, and then got to know the farmers in Guadalupe, Santa Maria area. And then he farmed just south of San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, 101 southbound. And you come back out to the Pacific Ocean, there's a housing development, and that was your grandfather's farm, right?
Right. That was the farm that he was able to start leasing in 1917, and my family held it until 1942 when they lost the lease and when they were incarcerated.
And they also, your family owned retail stores in Japantown, right?
Right.
The South Higuera.
Right, just at the edge of town, opposite the what used to be the railroad depot. And they own the storefronts right at South and South Higuera, storefronts and a hotel. My mother had just turned 21, and the property had just been turned over to her. And we have documents that show that she signed it over to a white realtor from Poston, Arizona, which was where she and her family had been incarcerated.
Wow, interesting. And it was pennies on the dollars they got.
Yeah, they got $2,000 for a property that they had invested well over $50,000 into and built a hotel and so forth. It's like the whole layered history of that is really interesting, because I found out from local military historian Eric Brune that the artillery unit that guarded the coast from Monterey down to Point Sal was a segregated all-black unit.
54th Artillery Regiment.
Right, right. I really admire historians like Eric Brune and James Papp that have all the data and the detail down. For the historical record, that's really important. I myself, I like to do visual art and I like to do poetry as well. So in sort of preparing for this exhibit that's coming up at the History Center, I've been looking around and noticing that a lot of people right now are not reading books and they are not particularly interested in history. So it's like, how do we tell the stories in different ways that will draw people? Mm-hmm. So we just finished up a series of two film screenings and a reading and writing workshop that gave people the opportunity for them to explore and share their stories, because I love that two-way dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then an exhibit at the San Luis Obispo County Library. And that exhibit includes a diverse group of artists and poets, and that'll be up for 2 months, and then it's moving to Camp San Luis Obispo, which is not going to be open to the public, but it'll be open to the folks that work in the National Guard there. And then hopefully it's going down to Hancock College in the fall, and I'm exploring other venues for it. It's a display of 24 images by about 6 different artists that include Peruvian-American artist and filmmaker Susana Aragon, African-American sculptor Lorraine Bonner, Chicano printmaker and educator Juan R. Fuentes, Chilean-American street artist Pancho Pescador, working with Peruvian-American poet Jose Antonio Galloso, and then myself, I'm a poet and an artist, among other things. So all of these writers and poets, artists, are from the Bay Area, and I've worked with many of them for a number of years. There's just so much to think about in terms of where are we coming from, what material are we carrying, what material have our parents and grandparents passed on to us about how we view ourselves and each other. So I just love doing this work, and I love all of the writers and artists I get a chance to work with. You know, we went through a period, too, of reclaiming cultural identity, which is really important and really powerful, but sort of got divided into separate pots of, you know, Latino culture, indigenous culture, Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Mexican. But there's so much diversity within each one of those and so much intersectionality. Mm-hmm. And I think especially for younger people nowadays, there are more and more cross-cultural relationships, friendships, etc. You know, I used to think, for instance, monolithically about Native American people, and I would talk to a Diné Navajo person, then find out that his mother was Diné, but his father was Shoshone or Paiute. And it's the same thing in China. You were not supposed to marry somebody from your own village. You were supposed to outmarry. So there are all of these things that bring in a diversity of experience. It's easy also to sort of look at a group and say, oh, okay, they're Chicano, they must all be poor. No. There are well-to-do, successful, accomplished people in every ethnicity and culture, they just may not get the recognition. There are some cultures that get raised really early. Be the first to raise up your hand. You want to be famous. You want to be well-known. You want to make a lot of money. And then there are other people that are raised to think family first, community first, you know, let someone else have the spotlight, support each other. It's about being in this together. And for me personally, I identify with that second way of being. And yeah. I think it's what we need right now because...
But that's kind of how you were raised.
That's how I was raised. Yeah. And a lot of other people. I mean, I, you know, when I see an older campesino, an older Mexican man, whether in Mexico or here, I just get this feeling. He reminds me of my own grandfather. And I give a slight bow of respect.
Yeah.
And you know what? They're really pleased to see that, and they nod back.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah. And a lot of times it starts a dialogue going. I pulled together this library show relatively quickly, and I reached out to some Chicano and Mexican artists that didn't have the time to participate. But I was lucky to get Chicano printmaker Juan Fuentes. We showed a 30-minute documentary about him called Strawberry Pickers, which we'd like to show again. Hopefully we'll have more opportunities to show that. But Juan has a wonderful story. He grew up in the farm labor camps around Watsonville. His parents were American-born in Arizona, just on the U.S. side of the border. But in those days, when his parents were young, there was no wall, and crossing the border was no big deal.
People did it every day.
Yeah, right. They'd people go visit would... their mm-hmm. auntie or their grandmother. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of people worked cross-border.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, or went to school across the border. Mm-hmm. But then his parents moved to California. They were in Fresno for a while, and he said he's glad he didn't stay in the valley. They moved up to Watsonville, and he just loved the coastal climate up here. I heard somebody, another writer, say, oh, I'm a costeño. Yeah, I'm a coastal person. Mm-hmm. Because there is something about that.
Very distinct, yeah.
And I'm pulled to it, too, which is, I mean, when I come down to Los Osos, I feel like I'm home. And in San Francisco, I live within a mile of the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's still that same it ocean is. Air.
Yeah, and the fog.
Yeah, yeah.
So to learn more about your world and the events and things upcoming in the near term.
Go to my website right now, sf.com. Mm-hmm. That's WRITENOWSF.com. And there are tons of pages there, so you can look up events, submissions, workshops, whatever. Also, another way to follow our events is to follow Right Now SF Bay on Eventbrite. And if you follow us, you'll get a notification every time we put an event online. Mm-hmm. Our events are free. It's really nice to get registration so that we know how many chairs to put out for an event. Mm-hmm. The series of four events that we just completed here in San Luis Obispo County, the four events drew 100 people, and the library exhibit will be up for two more months. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it happened to be a rainy day last Saturday, and we had 100 people come to the Strawberry Pickers.
Excellent. And Sunday you had something too, right?
Sunday we had a writing workshop, and there were 12 people who showed up. But that's a good number for a writing workshop because it allowed us to get really intimate. And it was really lovely. It also, there was a mix of people of color and white folks, and we were able to really see the commonalities across culture and across race. My name is Shizue Siegel, working with the History Center of San Luis Obispo County, preparing to do an exhibit. It's going to explore Japanese American history, the intersectionality with economics and with immigrants and other people of color over time.
I'm Tom Wilmer.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's finish up with an episode of Playing with Food from our archives, but the topic is always fresh, bees and honey.
You've heard of a beeline? You know, if someone makes a beeline for something, they're making a direct path to that.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
Bees will make a beeline toward the entrance of the hive. And if you stand in the way of that beeline, you're gonna get hit by a bee, and that makes them unhappy. This path right here, you can see the bees are coming in, that is their beeline. So we basically wanna stay out of the way of that. And as long as we do that, we can work in the back here without causing an issue.
Bees, they produce honey. It's a simple process, yet infinitely complex. And it's certainly fascinating. The Playing with Food team ventured out into the world of honey production, but full disclosure, you're going to hear more about bees. We start in Sea Canyon near Avila Beach.
I am Jeremy Rose, owner of the California Bee Company, and we have bees and sell local honey.
How long have you been in business?
About 18 years, and I've been keeping bees for about 20 years. Beekeeping kind of comes down to a couple of things: having a good place to put them, having bees, and having plenty of flowers blooming all around, because that's their food. So there are a lot of skills that you kind of need as a beekeeper to keep them healthy, but basically you need a good place to put them with plenty of flowers. Today we are here at Sea Canyon Fruit Ranch in San Luis Obispo, kind of near Avila Beach. And here, this is a unique climate. We have quite a variety of different things. Right now the bees just finished up bringing in some honey from a California native shrub called the toyon bush. Before that, the bees were working on some wild black sage that grows in kind of all the hills throughout Central and Southern California. We also are standing in an apple and pear orchard, which gives the honey an amazing appley, peachy, fruity flavor.
How do you know what flowers they are feeding off of?
The bees are generalists, and they will go to a variety of different species, even overlapping at the same time. There are certain individual foraging bees that will hone in on a certain flower, such as the wild sage. One of the ways that the beekeeper can figure out what they're going to is, number one, just walk around and see what the bees are on. Kind of one of my favorite ways, especially for the wild black sage, is to look at the bees when they're coming into the hive. And as they're flying in, they will have kind of a little whitish, bluish pollen streak across their face, because the sage flower is set up to put pollen right on their face like that. So that's kind of an interesting way for the sage, but there's a lot of ways. The honey tastes different, it looks different, the hives have a different smell when they're on different things. It's always kind of a blend, but when something is blooming really, really strong, such as the sage, then we will make almost exclusively sage honey. Say it's 90% sage honey in the particular batch, which is really interesting.
So your same bees produce different honey throughout the year depending on what's blooming?
Absolutely. So throughout the season, we can do manzanita honey, we can do apple honey, we can do sage honey, toyon honey, raspberry honey, blackberry honey. I just got back last night from a spot where I do artichoke blossom honey. It can be all from the same hives. It's all a matter of taking the old honey out and then letting the bees fill up with the new batch.
Where did your bees come from?
When I was starting, I started with a swarm of bees that I caught here in San Luis Obispo, and I started with a full colony that my beekeeping professor at Cal Poly helped me go get out of somebody's backyard. And when I started this business, it was me and a friend. So me and another Cal Poly student started the business together. We kept those two hives just in his backyard. And come springtime, we were able to start splitting the hives. We bought a few other hives here and there, but mainly just starting from a small number, we were able to get up to, I think, around 70 or 80 hives just during the first season. From there, it's just a matter of doing that every year, and one hive can become many just naturally. Say a hive starts with maybe 5,000 bees in it. One hive can build up to over 50,000 bees, and you can actually split them just by giving them a new queen bee, so you can split them into multiple.
Do you find the queen bee among the newbies?
The queen bee is hard to find. So the queen bee is a notorious, complicated process. Each one of these hives, it's a stack of boxes, so each one of those stacks has one queen bee in there. So the only way to find it is to start pulling out frames and start looking for it. And that's really the only way to find it. You might get lucky, she might be on the first frame, or you might just have horrible luck and she is just crawling around on the floor and you don't find it until the very, very end.
And how do you know she's the queen?
So as a beekeeper, you get used to what the queen looks like. She has a particular body shape. She's a little bit bigger. Mainly, she is a little bit longer and she just has a little different look to her. She might be a slightly different color from the other bees sometimes. So you look for all those things. Sometimes she will have what's called a retinue, where maybe 7 to 14 bees are all facing her. Maybe you'll just notice that pattern where there are a bunch of bees all facing the same direction, and sure enough, the queen's right in the middle right there, right where they're taking good care of her. We don't actually put her with the new hive so that she won't fight with the new queen. So the new queens, I have those, they're in little cages. I actually produce those. So I already have those ready to go. That's a whole nother process right there. And then separate out maybe say like 5 frames of bees, put those into a new box and take them to a new place, and then I can put the new queen in there.
So are they mating with the queen?
The queen bee is the mother of all the bees in the colony. So as she lays eggs, all of the worker bees are her daughters. She does lay some males. Say there's 50,000 female bees in the colony, there might be a couple thousand male bees in there. The males are called drones, and the males actually fly during the day, and they're just hanging out there in nature, hanging out in a little group of male bees. It's called the drone congregation area because the male is called the drone. And they're just waiting for a new unmated queen from another colony, maybe from far away. They can fly a few miles and they will mate with queens from other colonies. So that's one of the ways that we get genetic diversity among our bees.
The majority of bees are female. I kind of had the impression when you had the queen bee and all the rest of the worker bees were male, but you're saying the worker bees are female. If these female bees are designed to serve the queen, like what's going on in the colony, really is my question. What's going on in the colony? Like what's the family dynamic?
It's kind of a weird family dynamic. So the family dynamic is, yes, the queen bee, she's the mother of all the worker bees, but the worker bees don't really serve her. They more rely on her to serve them.
Okay, this is a good place to pause before it gets too complicated. You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian in Sea Canyon between San Luis Obispo and Avila Beach watching bees make honey. I also explored a hobby honey production. Lots of similar things said, starting with bee collection.
My name is Rob Dirksen, and we are just checking out some of my hobby hives. We are off of Bee Canyon Road. I was keeping bees when I lived in LA, just as a hobby. The thing that got me interested was the colony collapse disorder and bees and how fascinating they are. And they're sort of magical creatures. Unfortunately, with all the nicotinamides and other poisons we use, it's hard on the bees. We believe that's what's contributing to the colony collapse disorder.
So you've been doing this for a while. How long have you been doing bees?
Oh, probably 10, 15 years.
How did you learn to do this?
YouTube. Well, what's funny is I just started watching a few YouTubes and then it went from there. And the more I learned about the bees, the more fascinating. I mean, I could go on and on talking about them because they are kind of amazing little creatures. What I'll do is in the spring is I'll just put some pheromone out in some of the hive boxes. That will attract, hopefully, a swarm to move in. And that makes a really easy swarm catch.
Oh, so you capture your own bees.
That's right. And sometimes I'll get calls from friends or from friends of friends who they have a swarm and they'll give me a call and I can come pick it up. And that way I can help both my friends out and the bees and give them a nice home. And then I'll set them up here. So bees like the smell of comb. It's like an old home and it's an easy for them. So if you put out a box that has comb in it already, they will smell that and they will be attracted to that. You can increase your odds by catching a swarm by adding a little queen pheromone in there. And that, if you're lucky, will get them. This is called a flow hive. So what we have here is a device that you can see the bees moving up and down here. They are depositing their nectar. And once they deposit their nectar, they fan it with their wings to dehydrate it. Once it gets full and dehydrated enough, they will cap that with wax. Honey is the only food that, as long as it's not exposed to air, will last forever. It's pretty magical. So the bees are, you can see, depositing into these vast comb. That liquidy there, it's semi-thick, but not completely. When it's completely dehydrated to the right moisture, they will cap that and they will totally cover that. And what the flow hive does is it's pretty ingenious. What they do is you turn a little lever and it breaks the comb and then the honey falls down and then you just collect it. It's a lot easier, a lot less labor intensive than the traditional way of collecting honey.
Bees produce food for us, and this show is about food. So what about the food stuff that is honey? My show is called Playing with Food, and honey is not only food for bees, but we've turned it into food for people.
It's a great food. It's a wonderful, it's the best food.
Okay, oh, yeah. Tell me, I don't even know what my question is. So, honey.
Yeah, honey is amazing. So, one of the things that kind of caused me to start doing this, there are several things that made me want to start doing my own honey and having my own bees, but one of them was learning that a lot of the honey that is available in grocery stores and on the market is contaminated. So a lot of it has been watered down with sugar or corn syrup or water. Even worse, a lot of it is contaminated with different pesticide chemicals. So that's one of the things that made me start this business, to do things differently, have them out here in really pristine places like this. The nice thing about producing honey is you get a different kind every location. I have several different spots just a mile apart, and we get a slightly different kind of honey at each spot. That's one of the things that really keeps me entertained, is year to year, the variations, and location to location, the variations. And I think that's what eating natural and producing your own food is all about.
If I was properly suited up and opened one of those boxes, what would I see?
So the first thing you'll notice if you open a box is that everything will be totally covered with bees. There's a lot more in there than you think there are. There's tens of thousands of bees in there, and the healthy hives will be totally covered. The way to move the bees off is puff a little bit of smoke, and they kind of instinctually move away from the smoke, and that also serves to calm them down. Open the lid, we'll put a little bit of smoke in there, a couple of puffs to calm the bees down, and then the next step is start prying out the frames. Everything is stuck together. The bees actually gum everything up with a material called propolis, which is bee resin. So propolis is tree resin that the bees gather, and they mix it with a little bit of beeswax, and they use that to seal everything up in the hive. So everything's kind of stuck, so we have to pry a frame out, and if it's totally full of honey, we will shake the bees off, give it a nice little shake. We literally shake them off, and the bees come off. The frame of honey goes in a separate box, and we will take that away to be extracted. And the extractor is simply a centrifuge that spins the frame, and the honey flies out, and then we can give the frame back to the bees.
But what is honey all about? Rob, out in Bee Canyon, offers the simple answer.
Well, what's interesting is it's not even the honey, it's at the bacteria. So what happens is when the bees are ingesting the nectar from a flower, they ingest it, and in their gut, it has bacteria. And so many different types of bacteria, we have not even identified them all. It's really the bacteria that's part of the magic of this. And then what happens is, I hope I don't gross people out, but when the bees are back in the hive, they'll actually pass that early honey from bee to bee. So they'll drink it and then regurgitate it and drink it and regurgitate it. So it gets passed around, and that's just part of the process. And it's really the bacteria inside the bee's, I guess, gut that is transforming that nectar into honey. Bee barf doesn't make it sound too appealing, but to some extent, it's a little bit, they do ingest it and then they also bring it back up.
Nature.
Yeah, it's, you know, magical.
It's magical. Now it's Jeremy's turn to take the concept of bee barf to the next level.
When we see bees flying around, they're just basically looking for food and eating. Now, is honey bee barf?
Okay, that's a good question. Is the honey bee barf? So no, it's not. If it was bee barf, they would be actually swallowing the nectar into their stomach and throwing up. But they actually have a separate organ, so they don't swallow it all the way. They put it into a clean, separate place, and they can put it back out without actually swallowing it all the way. So when the forager bee goes to a flower, she goes until her honey stomach is full, and then she comes back to the colony, and she basically hands it off to another bee that moves it up into the hive and stores it somewhere.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian with the Playing with Food team, and we're learning about honey. Jeremy from the California Bee Company is describing the soap opera that goes on in the hive. Just a warning, it gets a bit dark.
So the family dynamic is, yes, the queen bee, she's the mother of all the worker bees, but the worker bees don't really serve her. They more rely on her to serve them. It all kind of is a weird relationship, because if the queen bee gets, say, too old, maybe she's a couple of years old, she's not moving very fast, she's not laying very many eggs every day, the worker bees will actually supersede her, where they will get rid of her and they will raise a new queen. It'll be one of her daughters, basically, will become the new queen.
A bee coup.
Yeah, it is. And sometimes it is more rough than other times. Like, sometimes they're pretty nice about it. They'll allow the old queen and the new queen to be in there together, which is nice, till the old one finally passes away. Sometimes they're a little more mean about it, and they'll just kill the old queen right away and then raise a new one. They will ball her. They actually form a ball, and they kind of sting and bite, and they overheat her. Isn't that sad? And they throw her out the front door.
Have you seen that happen?
Oh yeah, we see that all the time.
We like them because they pollinate things, right? Like most fruits and vegetables we wouldn't have if we didn't have bees, because they pollinate, right? What do they think they're doing?
They're just looking for food. So when the bee pollinates a flower, she's looking for something to eat. Their only food is the nectar, which they turn into honey. So that's the sweet stuff. That's their carbohydrate. And the pollen from the flower. So when they move the pollen around, that does the function of pollination for the plant, but the bee is just there to gather some food. So the pollen supplies all of their protein needs and the minerals and vitamins and the lipids.
Honey is their canning process.
That's true. So the honey is the only food that never goes bad, for one thing. They do find honey sealed up inside the pyramids, and as long as it was sealed up that whole time, it's still good. And the bees are doing that to store up for lean times. So they work hard during the spring and summer when the flowers are blooming, and hopefully they store enough in the colony that they can open their pantry during lean, tough times and survive until the beginning of spring. We always try to leave typically around 35 to 40 pounds of honey with every hive, and that's always enough to make them have enough to survive. If you leave more than that, what we found is that there's too much space in the colony. These hives are stacked up as multiple boxes. So some of these are 3 and 4 boxes. For the winter time, that's too much space, and the bees can't keep that much space warm. They just have too much dead air space in there. So it actually works out well for them if we take out whatever honey is in the top 2 boxes and just reduce all that space down to just 2 bee boxes, or even 1 in some situations works well. And then they have just enough air space in there and just enough honey in there that they have everything they need to be healthy.
They just huddle together to keep warm.
They do. They actually form what's called a wintering cluster, and they keep it about 96 degrees in the middle. That's the temperature they like for their brood, which is the young.
We've heard from Jeremy at the California Bee Company and Rob, who has hobby hives. Both of them shared the intrigue of the diversity of honey.
Does this mean that there is an unlimited styles of honey because there are unlimited types of pollen?
Absolutely. The pollen itself, we consider that to be more their protein, but it's the nectar itself that comes from the flowers. So since there are basically an unlimited number of different species of flowers and combinations thereof that can be blooming, overlapping, and at different locations, it is totally unlimited what we can get. Sometimes we'll have total surprises, but then some of them are fairly dependable, such as the sage. Even that causes trouble, though, in drought years. So that brings us to the next issue. We have had major problems because of the ongoing drought, and it tends to be kind of feast or famine.
So you centrifuge the honey, and then you bottle it, and then you sell it. What's, you know, cool and groovy and interesting about centrifuge to customer?
It is really cool because I have all these little micro batches. We just use a small system. That's kind of one of the things that distinguishes us from some of the really large commercial beekeepers, or even what's called honey packers that sell the honey that you see at the grocery stores. When we extract it, every little batch is slightly different. So even if we're selling sage honey, one batch might have a little bit of a bubblegummy taste from those sage flowers. It's just tastes that come through from the flowers. It's almost like wine. Different flavors come through. And maybe another batch will have kind of a peachy or apple-y flavor. And even one batch has almost a hint of mintiness or peppermint taste to it, which is really, really good.
Different times of year, depending on when you collect the honey, the flavor will be different. That's the thing with most commercial honey. What they do is they collect it from all over. They mix it all together to make it all taste the same, which is kind of too bad because there's millions of different types of flavors. You know, there's dark honey that might come from avocado trees or black sage that I have here. And the darker honey tends to have more minerals and has a lot of health benefits. The sweeter honey, like that might come from orange blossoms, they're very sweet, so it's almost a little bit like wine. You can have different types of honey for different types of food, depending on what you want.
And then I tasted some honey.
You can see that this is darker than what most honey you might buy
it's
at the store.
Very dark, yeah. It looks like molasses, almost.
Yeah. It's nice and thick, which means it's nice and dehydrated. Sometimes, if you collect honey too early before, like I said, they've completely dehydrated it, it will have too much moisture. And the moisture, it will rot, actually turns to mead. You want it at the right moisture level. So, do you want it just straight up?
Sure.
Okay, let's do it.
That's really nice. Doesn't taste anything like honey that you'd buy at the grocery store.
Right.
It's got a very, is earthy flavor?
Yeah,
earthy
it's
flavor?
A little more earthy, yeah. It has a lot more, it just has a lot more flavors. It's sort of, again, like wine. Like if you pay attention, you can taste the sage, you can taste poison oak, you can taste, we have a lot of avocado trees and oak trees and pepper trees. And that's all in there.
Honey is fascinating. Bees are fascinating. There was so much to learn. If you are a fan of honey and you are eating honey bought in a grocery store, whether high volume production or specialty honey, I suggest that you venture further from the hive and try some local honey. Like all local produce I have tasted in the course of producing Playing With Food, it's incomparable. Jeremy couldn't have encapsulated it better.
These are some of the most tired, stressed out people. So they need you to be nice to them. So be nice to your local beekeeper. Buy some honey at the farmer's market instead of the grocery store. Help a guy out. If he looks like he's barely staying awake, it's because he was moving his bees all night.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm Playing With Food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.